The Leslie Marshall Show, a true democracy in talk radio. Of, for, and by you, the people.
This is Mark Levine proudly filling in for Leslie. For the first 2 hours tonight, you're going to have Leslie in the third hour, so you'll get a bit of both of us. I got a lot to talk about in my 2 hours. Two main topics tonight. The first, we started it. You may have heard me talking with Leslie on Tuesday night, talking about Libya, but specifically talking about the law of war, and specifically when in America, when in the United States, under U.S. law, not international law, when under our law, under our Constitution, when the president can take us to war, when Congress can take us to war, when it requires both of them, when one can go without the other. It's a complex constitutional, historical question, and I'm going to be going through it in detail tonight so you can answer your conservative friends. You remember the conservative friends, the same ones that were saying, well, why is Obama sitting on the side not doing anything, and now they're complaining he's doing too much? Yeah, to answer them. And then, I don't know if it's more important, equally important, I want to talk about a play I saw last night. Now, I don't usually do theater reviews. That's not what Leslie's show is about. That's not what my show, The Inside Scoop, is about. But I saw a play last night in Washington, D.C. that really made me think, really opened up my eyes, really made me think about America and what we would be like without unions. We, of course, have the smallest union membership now in the United States of America than at any time since the Great Depression. Only about 7% or so of people working in private businesses, and only about 30% of those working for the government are in unions. Of course, you know what's going on in Wisconsin. You know it's not just Wisconsin. It's going on in Ohio and Indiana and states across the country. Republicans are trying to take America's out of unions, and out of beating private unions so hard, now they're beating public unions, saying, oh, we're fine with the 7% of Americans in private unions. We want to get the 30% of Americans out of public unions. Well, last night I saw a show that I highly recommend to anyone in the Washington, D.C. area. It's called The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs. It's a one-man show by performer, writer Mike Daisy, and I'll tell you all about it in the second part of the show. But he describes, through a wonderful tour de force of Apple computer and technology, and if you are a technology geek the way I am, or frankly I'm not near the technology geek than some other people I know, but if you love to play with technology, you'll understand where he was going. But he goes to a darker place. He goes to the place where our technology is made. He literally goes to China and meets the people working there under impossible working conditions, child labor. He basically goes back in time to the way the United States was 100, 110, 120 years ago, the time that my great-grandparents came to this country. And in doing so, I think, to me, there's two cautionary tales. One is what's happening today, why American workers are suffering today. We're suffering today because we have to compete with basically slave labor. And there's no way to compete with slave labor. Slave labor will always be cheaper than American labor. And secondly, he's showing us our future. He's telling us what happens in China, which is horrible, and we'll talk about that. But he's also showing us our future, where Republicans want us to go. They basically want us to go back to slavery, or at least to the 1890s, when American workers worked in slave-like conditions. So there's a lot to talk about this hour. As always, you can call in and tell me I'm wrong, or tell me I'm right, or tell me you miss Leslie, whatever you want to tell me. 888-653-7543. 888-653-7543. You can also post on Facebook. You can go to the Mark Levine fan page. I'll be looking for your comments there, and tell me what your thoughts are. Let me start on Libya, or more broadly, start on basic history, legal history, constitutional history, and talk about the president and the Congress going to war. Because as many of you know, many of you have heard me before, I sort of the main fill in for Leslie when she's gone, know that I am a lawyer, graduate of Yale Law School. I'm a constitutional lawyer. I have a special emphasis in constitutional law. I go on TV. I whip out my pocket constitution. If you've seen me, you know that that's something that I care very strongly about. And I am proudly a liberal, strict constructionist, meaning that I firmly believe the words of the Constitution have meaning, and if we don't like them, we need to change them by amendment or so forth. So as a liberal, you might imagine that I am squeamish about presidents going to war by themselves. And you're right, I am. I am as a liberal, I am also as a strict constructionist. After all, it says very clearly in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution that Congress shall have the power to declare war. And some believe that's enough. That answers the question. Only Congress can declare war. The president can't act without Congress. And therefore, pretty much every war we've had since World War II has been illegitimate. After all, the last time Congress met and formally declared war was in 1942. Actually, I mean, the most famous one, of course, was after Pearl Harbor. In December 7, 1941, Roosevelt brought the Congress in joint session and I think it was 3 days later, 2 days later, 3 days later, declared war on Japan and on Germany. We actually declared war a few months later on some of the other axes like Hungary and so forth in 1942. But in 70 years or so, there has been no formal declaration of war. That's right. All those wars that we fought, Korea comes to mind, Vietnam comes to mind, the Persian Gulf War comes to mind. Oh, I don't know, Afghanistan, Iraq, heck, even Grenada comes to mind. Kosovo, none of them had declarations of war. And there are legal scholars, it's true, who say that basically every war since World War II has been illegitimate. And many of them are liberal. Some are on the right. If you find the strongest criticism of President Obama's actions in Libya has come from two main sources, the left and the right. Dennis Kucinich on the left has said that this may well be an impeachable offense, the president sending our military to action without Congress. But on the right, you have Ron Paul, classic libertarian, who also is strongly condemning the action, and not just, let's say, gadflies like Ron Paul, but very respectable conservative legal pundits like George Will, who, while I certainly am not a conservative, I respect him. I respect his point of view. I think he's a reasonable conservative. I think those things do exist. They're rare, but they exist. And Pat Buchanan and the like, they're very much opposed on the right. So people on the left, people on the right condemning Obama for acting without Congress. And you got, of course, people on the left, people on the right for saying, who are condemning him for not acting sooner, not acting more quickly. If you heard my show, you know that I myself, I might as well put my cards on the table, I definitely criticized President Obama before he acted, encouraging him to act. I even called my members of Congress. Member of Congress and senators, and urge him to act. They told me no, but I at least called. So I am a proponent of intervention, and I think there are two issues here with regard to Libya, two legal issues. One legal issue and one moral issue. The moral issue does not break down under liberal conservative lines. Until I went on Leslie's show Tuesday, I did not know how she stood, because I have to tell you, there are people on the left that support our action. There are people on the left who don't support our action. There are people on the right that support our action. There are people on the right who don't support our action. This is not a left-right issue. This is what I call an isolationist interventionist issue, right? Dennis Kucinich is on the left. He opposes it. Leslie and I are on the left, and we support it. John Kerry supported the war, and he's certainly a liberal. On the right, John McCain supported the war. George Will does not. Pat Buchanan, Ron Paul does not. So there are always people who believe that America should act kind of as the world's policeman, and people that say we should not. We should stay home and take care of domestic concerns. And the answer is, in my view, they're both right. I mean, we should take care of domestic concerns. We should always take care of domestic concerns. But I don't believe we should exclusively take care of domestic concerns. I think there are times when we need to act in the world. But I'd be the first to say we shouldn't always act in the world. We can't overthrow every dictator on earth. I wish we could. So one is the classic policy question. I think everyone needs to ask this for themselves. And everyone needs to address for themselves. And it's tough because every country is different. When do you believe it's moral and just for the United States to intervene? When is it right? When should we go in? Because the big complaint about President Obama, the big complaint about U.S. intervention is that we're not consistent, right? We're intervening in Libya, but we didn't intervene in Egypt. We didn't intervene in Tunisia. We're not intervening in Yemen or Bahrain. What's up? We went in Iraq. We went in Afghanistan. It's inconsistent. Why are we going in one and not the other? And I strive, as a talking head, as a pundit, I strive for consistency. I strive for philosophical consistency. I try really hard to say in advance, without looking at where we are on Earth, because obviously it would be wrong to intervene because of the ethnicity of the people involved, or in my humble opinion, it's wrong to intervene because one place has oil, another place doesn't. I try really hard to have a consistent policy. Now, you know, times change. Sometimes we've got more money to spend. Sometimes we're my co-hosts on the Raucous Caucus, which is a radio show I do in Washington, D.C., they were both liberal and they were both opposed to our intervention because one is, I think, always opposed to U.S. intervention. He's more of the Dennis Kucinich type. And the other one was like, well, if we weren't in Iraq and Afghanistan, I would support intervention. And I've said that we need to get out of both Iraq and Afghanistan. Not entirely, but mostly. 90, 95% out. So it's a confusing question. And then, apart from the moral question, the philosophical question, the one that you don't have to agree with me. You don't have to come down where I do. Of course you don't. But you should have an answer for yourself. You know, the Bible says there's a time for war and a time for peace. When is the time for war in your mind? If you're a pacifist, there's never a time for war. And that's a respectable philosophy. It's one, I'm afraid, though, that gets you in a lot of trouble. I have a lot of respect for Tibetan Buddhists. A lot of respect. It's a peaceful, pacifist, beautiful religion. And when the Chinese came to conquer Tibet, they did not fight back. In fact, many of them set themselves on fire. And you can feel horror and pity for them, and I do. But because they didn't fight back, I would argue that's why Tibet is under Chinese control today. Now, maybe they could never have fought back. China's way too powerful a power. But you can be a pacifist. You can be against all military action. That's not me. And I don't think it's most liberals. I mean, Harry Truman, Franklin Roosevelt, Bill Clinton. I don't know of any liberal president who was a pacifist. But if you think there is a time for war, when's that time? Is it only when America is attacked? Is that it? Is that your limit? What about genocide? Should we intervene to help some people all the way on the other side of the earth who's being attacked and mercilessly murdered by some other people? Then should we intervene? Does it depend on who's fighting them? If the country's powerful or not? Does it depend on whether we have U.S. interests at stake? And I mean commercial interests. And yes, I mean oil. Does that matter? Oil or diamonds or anything else? Does it matter if it's a religious war, one fighting against another? Does it matter if the people we're fighting for support democracy or if they don't? When is war just? It's a very difficult question. I'm going to try to answer that, at least the way I come down. I want to hear from you, too, at 888-653-7543. And also, when is it legally right under American law? Believe it or not, as tough as the legal question is, I think it's easier than the moral question. So I'm going to deal with that first. You can call in on either question, 888-653-7543. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine filling in for Leslie Marshall. You ever heard the Marine hymn? From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. You ever heard it? Do you know what the heck they're talking about? Do you know who Montezuma was? You might know where Tripoli is because you've probably been watching the news about Libya. Montezuma, by the way, was the leader of Mexico who we overthrew in one of our many wars. And Tripoli, the shores of Tripoli, did you know that this is not the first war we've had with that area of the country, of the world? It's not even the second. In fact, I think there were two. I don't think there were three. There were at least two wars, 1805, maybe 1808. It was the first decade of the 19th century, where we fought the Barbary pirates. don't know about you, but every time I think of a pirate, I imagine they have a parrot on their shoulder and an eye patch. And I don't know whether the Barbie pirates had parrots, but I do know that in the early years of the 19th century, we fought a non-declared war in Libya. So Dennis Kucinich, you know, if you want to impeach Barack Obama, you're going to have to go back and impeach Thomas Jefferson. Because in 1805, Thomas Jefferson fought a war in Libya. Now, was it really a war? I mean, they were just pirates, right? Well, they were pretty dangerous pirates. They were kidnapping American seamen, and going on to commercial ships and American flagged ships and taking our stuff. And we fought back, and we did not declare war. So what are the declared wars of the United States? Well, there's the Revolutionary War. That's true. There's the War of 1812. The Civil War, I don't even know that the Civil War was declared, but of course that was, you know, between us. The Mexican War was declared, the Spanish-American War, World War I and World War II, and that's it. Those are all the times that Congress used its right under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution to declare war. But as you well know, there have been many wars, or things people call wars, without Congress declaring war. It'd be hard-pressed not to call the conflicts in Korea and Vietnam war. We lost some 50,000 Americans in Vietnam in that police action, military action, advisors on the ground. Those were a heck of a lot of advisors. And, you know, Americans were drafted to advise the government of South Vietnam. You know, I don't think that's what our troops were thinking. They don't call it the Vietnam advice. It was the Vietnam War. So how were all of those legal if Congress didn't declare war? Some legal historians say they weren't. We got a lot of impeachment to do. And not just Richard Nixon, John Kennedy, Harry Truman. We got a lot of people to impeach if the only rule about war is Congressional Declaration of War. But the Constitution has meaning. I insist. I'm a strict constructionist. So what do those words mean? When can Congress prevent the president from going to war? I'm going to answer all these questions for you when I come back. If you want to join the discussion, it's 888-653-7543. This is Mark Levine. I'll be back in a bit. Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine filling in for Leslie Marshall and trying to answer the question of when is war legal and when is war just. Easy questions, right? You know, obviously it's clear when war is legal, it's clear when war is just. No, they're not easy questions, but still, I think we have an obligation to try to answer them. And the question of when it's legal, though a tough question, is an easier question. So, the Constitution, as I said, Article 1, Section 8, gives Congress the power to declare war. And some people think that's the be-all and end-all. And some people would say that every war we fought, from the Barbary pirates in 1805 on the shores of Tripoli, from Thomas Jefferson all the way up through the Korean War and the Vietnam War and the Afghanistan War and the Iraqi War and the Persian Gulf War, that none of those were declared wars, and none of those are constitutional, and probably half American presidents should be impeached. But the Constitution also says that the president has powers with regard to the military. In fact, if you look at Article 1 and Article 2 of the Constitution, people who have never really taken the time to read the Constitution are always shocked by how large Article 1 is, that deals with Congress, and how short Article 2 is, that deals with the president. If you look at Article 2, dealing with the President of the United States, Section 1 is really, really long and goes through the whole Electoral College and the fact that the vice president takes over and he's got to be a natural-born citizen. So basically, it deals with how you become president, all right? Section 4 says he can remove the president from office if he's terrible. Section 3 basically says who he can appoint, ambassadors and cabinet and such, and he's got to take care of the laws, be faithfully executed, which sounds well and good, but, you know, it's not quite clear what that is. Really, the heart of what the president does is in Article 2, Section 2, and most of that just says that he appoints people and you know, signs laws and makes treaties and fills up vacancies. When you get to his actual rights, the unique rights of the President of the United States, it's kind of just one clause. Well, there's the one clause mentions pardons. He can do pardons. And the other thing he does, and I quote, "The president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States, and of the militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States. That's what he does. He's our commander-in-chief. And, of course, our first president, George Washington, was also our main general. So it kind of fit. So we have this inherent conflict, right? Congress declares war, and the president is the commander-in-chief. Now, you could say, and I think this is a very reasonable construction of the Constitution. You can say, okay, Congress decides when we go to war, and the president does the details. Now, that makes a lot of sense. In fact, arguably, that's exactly what the words mean. Who decides when we go to war? Congress decides when we go to war. Once Congress decides, you don't want a committee saying, let's flank them to the left and send the cavalry from the north. That would be bad. One, it would be public. It wouldn't be secret. And by the time you got a bunch of committees around the Senate filibuster, we would have been invaded. So it makes sense to have one person be commander-in-chief and decide how to conduct a war. So I think that's certainly true. And you could argue that's the way the Constitution is, and it's just been breached by many, many, many presidents. You can also look a little more detail at Article 1, the one talking about Congress. And it says something very interesting. It says that Congress has the power to raise and support armies, but can't do it for longer than 2 years. And Congress should provide and maintain a navy. Now, words matter, and those words are different. And you might not catch how they're different upon first reading. Raise and support an army, provide and maintain a navy. There's a difference. When you maintain something, when you provide something and maintain it, it stays. You're maintaining something. It's there the whole time. When you raise something, it's coming from new, right? Raise and support an army, that means there's no army, and you can create one, but not longer than 2 years. And a navy, you basically keep it all the time. And that's because our founding fathers thought there should not be a standing army. They didn't want a standing army. They didn't trust a standing army. They didn't like the British standing army. And they said, if we're going to fight a war, Congress will declare it. You're going to raise and support an army. And if you got some emergency, that's what the militias are for. That's why we have the Second Amendment. Right, that's why we have well-regulated militias, because the people of the several states can join, can bear arms in their well-regulated militias, and if we get invaded, we'll have the militias of the several states, and then if we really need to fight a war, Congress will declare war, and we'll raise and support armies. Isn't that quaint? That may well have, that did make sense, I dare to say, in the 18th century. I don't think it makes sense for the world power that we are today. Indeed, the world's sole superpower. But in this context, you can raise an army, but you maintain a navy. That justifies Thomas Jefferson and the Barbary Pirates, right? He didn't have to raise a navy. The navy was already there. It was maintained. So when the Barbary Pirates did their pirating things off the shores of Tripoli, he could go in and we could fight what's called the First Barbary War without a declaration of war by Congress. It gets trickier after World War II. Now, don't get me wrong. There were lots of interventions before World War II where we did not declare war. Yes, we went down to Mexico, to the halls of Montezuma. Not just in the U.S.-Mexican War. Indeed, in the 1920s, we went down and chased a Mexican leader that we didn't like. I believe it was Pancho Villa. We went, even invaded Russia in the early Soviet Union. Did you know that? Did you know we sent troops there in around 1920? Really, ever since we became a world power in 1898, ever since the Spanish-American War, we've done all kinds of actions all across the globe. So when did that suddenly become legal? You could say, well, the Constitution says, you know, you can't. You can't. The Congress declares the war. The president executes the war. Harry Truman said in the Korean action, he said that because the United States joined the United Nations, that changed things. Because the United Nations the joining of the United Nations was a treaty, which the president has a right to do, and we certainly joined the United Nations. And according to the rules of the United Nations, the Security Council enforces various actions. And therefore, in the Korean War, which was declared by the United Nations but not declared by the United States, Harry Truman said, look, we joined the UN, and the UN authorized it, and that's good enough. So we never had a congressional declaration of war in Korea. Now, in Vietnam, there was no UN resolution. What's our excuse for Vietnam? Well, Lyndon Johnson said it was the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, a resolution entirely based on a lie. I know my history. We claimed that the Viet Cong, the communist North Vietnamese, bombed a ship. They didn't bomb. I know it's all fake, but we did get a vote from Congress to go to war in Vietnam. Heck, George W. Bush did the same thing, right? He completely lied to us about weapons of mass destruction. And yet that lie led Congress to authorize the war in Iraq before the fact. It's true. So apparently if a president lies to get us into war and Congress authorizes it, that's okay. Well, I don't know if it's okay. But if Congress authorizes a war, it's legal. Even after September 11th, Congress authorized us to fight back in Afghanistan. That's true. That I think was more of self-defense. But whatever you agree with the war or not, Congress authorized it. Well, what about when the president acts when Congress doesn't authorize it? And don't think Obama's the only one. The clearest example is President Reagan in Grenada, right? He didn't get congressional authorization. He just went in, had a nice little weekend war, invaded Grenada. In fact, I happen to know, and I won't give out names because this person wouldn't appreciate it, but I know some of the people that worked for the State Department at the time of the war in Grenada, and I've been told from a reliable source that Ronald Reagan started the invasion of Grenada and then gave the State Department 48 hours to justify the fact that he was already invading Grenada. And they dusted off the treaty of the Eastern Caribbean Treaty that no one seemed to remember, and that was the justification. Well, Congress in 1973, following the Vietnam War, had had enough of presidents going to war without their authorization, had enough of presidents saying Article 1, Section 8, that Congress has the power to declare war, has no meaning. And so in 1973, a Democratic Congress with some Republicans passed over Richard Nixon's veto, the War Powers Act. Now, of course, to pass a law over a president's veto, you need two-thirds of both houses of Congress, which tells you it wasn't just Democrats, but Republicans, too, voted for this. And they voted for the War Powers Act. And scholars have always argued about whether or not it's constitutional. But what does the War Powers Act say? It says that in an emergency, the president can act, can send troops, can begin military action, like Reagan in Grenada, like Obama in Libya. But within 60 days thereafter, the president has to go and get congressional approval. And if he doesn't do that, then he's got to withdraw troops within the following 30 days. So basically, the president can act by himself for about 90 days. Himself or herself. We haven't had a female president yet. I certainly hope one day we do. But the president can act alone for 90 days. And then if Congress doesn't retroactively ratify that, you got to withdraw troops. And what's fascinating about the War Powers Act is that people have complained on both sides. There are presidents that say it's unconstitutional, that it restricts the power of the president, that the president has power under Article 2 of the Constitution as military commander-in-chief to do whatever he wants, and who cares what Congress says, he can go forward. It's unconstitutional because it restricts the power of the president. And there are certainly people in Congress, Dennis Kucinich will be one of them, that would say that the War Powers Act is unconstitutional because it restricts the power of Congress. Congress has to declare war. The president can't just go in, even for 60 days. It's unconstitutional, he can't go in for one day. And none of this authorization like we did for Iraq and Afghanistan. You need a formal declaration of war like we did on Pearl Harbor. And there's no answer to the question because it's never gone to the United States Supreme Court, because usually when President and Congress fights, the third branch of government tries to stay out of it. No one's ever really challenged it. But I happen to like the War Powers Act. I happen to think it's a nice mix, particularly in the modern age, of combining the power of president and the power of Congress. And I firmly believe that while President Obama had the right to act in an emergency, I think you have to be able to act in an emergency in this crazy world in which we live. I do think he's got to get retroactive approval by Congress. I do think he has to do it in the next 60 days. I think he will get it in the next 60 days, but if he doesn't, I think he's got to get out. And we'll talk about that on the other side of the break. The toll-free number is 888-653-7543. Right back after this. Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. So there have been all kinds of presidential actions, both before and after the War Powers Act. We sent troops to Somalia. We sent troops to Lebanon. There's certainly the war in Kosovo. There's lots of things the president have done. Now, usually, though not always, usually these things are done with a veneer of an international support. And, of course, in this case, in Libya, Barack Obama actually got UN Security Council support. But the clearest example that I can think of is Ronald Reagan Grenada. I mean, there was no international support for that one. He just wanted to invade and did. Now, it didn't last very long. The shorter wars don't. And there's been times when they've done the whole war without any congressional approval. But the longer wars always do get congressional approval. In sum and substance, I do think what Barack Obama has done is legal. If it's not legal, then he joins a long line of presidents that have violated the law. Again, it's never been ruled by the United States Supreme Court. But it would be ridiculous to suggest that he's acting any differently from any other president. In fact, I think he's acted a lot more modestly than other presidents. So that's the legal case. As I said, that's actually the easier one. The more interesting question, I think, the more difficult question is the philosophical question. When is war just? As I said at the outset, if you're a pacifist and you think war is never just, that is a certainly a consistent philosophical view. But I guess I think pacifists get beat up. Nice guys finish last. If you turn the other cheek and you get punched in the other cheek, you're not going to be standing up for very long. I'm sorry to say that. I wish the world weren't that way. I wish that pacifism worked. And sometimes nonviolence is absolutely right. Whether it's Martin Luther King in the civil rights era or Mahatma Gandhi for India, when you're dealing with a democracy, I would say that usually nonviolence is the best way to fight back. You appeal to people's consciences. If they're the majority and you're the minority, it is the only way to fight back. If you're a minority and you resort to violence, you're never going to win. They're bigger than you. Nonviolence is the way to go. But when you're attacked by a dictator, or when a dictator is seeking to massacre his own people, that's when, yeah, I think war is just. Let me give you the Mark Levine rule of when war is just, and then when we come up at the top of the hour, you can tell me whether you believe I'm right or wrong. I think war is just primarily, pretty much in two cases. One, when the United States is attacked. Okay, after September 11th, I did support the war in Afghanistan. Now, I think we went too far. I think we're there too long. I think it's time to come home. But the initial idea of confronting the Taliban, who with Al-Qaeda, murdered 3,000 Americans, I did support the war in Afghanistan. In fact, as you may well know, every member of Congress, save one, supported the war in Afghanistan. Every single one. So it wasn't it was 99% Democrats and 100% Republicans supported that. So when we're attacked, self-defense, that's pretty basic. The United Nations Charter, in fact, says you can use force in self-defense. Now, you can argue, still, is it really worth self-defense, in this case, when there were terrorists outside a nation state and so forth. But self-defense, that's pretty clear. And I'm going to argue there's something else as well. I'm going to argue when we can prevent mass murder, when we can prevent a massacre, when we can prevent genocide, when we can prevent a leader who says, as Muammar Gaddafi said, I'm going to find you, I'm going to go into your house, I'm going to go into your closets, and I'm going to show no pity and no mercy. When a leader threatens to massacre civilians in massive numbers, I would argue, when it comes to something like genocide, when it comes to something like mass murder, if we can prevent it, and listen, we can't save China. We can't save Tibet from China. China's too powerful. But if we can prevent it, I think we have a moral obligation after the Holocaust, after Rwanda, after Darfur. And listen, I was very strongly arguing that we needed to intervene in Rwanda and Darfur. After all of that, I think if you're powerful enough to stop it, you have a moral obligation. Just like if you see a kid beating up another kid in the playing at recess, and you're there and you're an adult and you don't even have to know the kids, if you can separate them without doing harm to yourself, you should. So I want to address that issue with you when we come back at the top of the hour, 888-653-7543. But before the break, I do want to talk briefly with Justin Duckman. Now, he's a reporter with Talk Radio News Service, and he apparently is going to be talking about Michelle Bachmann and NATO, two things that I can't think have anything in common. But tell me, Justin, what do you have to share with us?
I just wanted to give you some variety.
All right, go for it.
But the more interesting stuff that is coming out today, more so than Michelle Bachmann, is the NATO relevations. It turns out that we are going to be passing the command on to NATO instead of the French-British partnership that was rumored earlier on. This is as far as the no-fly zone goes. We just had Secretary Clinton come out not too long ago and essentially say that Gaddafi still remains a threat, and made an attempt to urge the international community to join the original U.S. mission of making sure that Gaddafi does not essentially slaughter the rebels right now.
Justin, let me ask you this. Now, Turkey, of course, was originally kind of ambivalent about our actions in Libya, not really saying no, but definitely not saying yes. And they were it was said that they were the ones who were holding NATO back. How did they resolve that issue?
Well, from what I'm able to tell, the Turks, the Turkish were really angered by a lot of the moves from the French. They were concerned that they were moving in too aggressively, that, you know, and that certainly wasn't quelled today by the reports of French planes shooting down one of Gaddafi's planes and also bombing a facility deep within the country.
But Justin,
and it
seems
that they may have just ended up supporting the NATO initiative as a way to keep the French from the control.
Well, that's exactly what I'm wondering. If the Turks are concerned that the French are too aggressive, and I'm on record, I support this, and I have for a long time, so my bias is clear. But if the Turks are concerned that the French are going too far, can the Turks, since this is part of NATO, can they keep the French from going too far? I mean, who's going to control? Is it the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, and who does he report to?
That is an interesting question. What's being discussed right now is setting up sort of a political establishment similar to ISAF, which we have right now in Afghanistan. And how that is going to be formed is going to roll out within the next few days.
Okay, so we'll find that out. We only got a few seconds left. I know you want to talk about Michelle Bachmann. What's she done now?
She's forming an exploratory committee. It's political theater.
Oh, she's running for president! I wonder if she'll look in the camera this time. I wonder if she'll figure that out. You know what? I love at least one crazy person running for president. Alan Keyes, I remember, ran a few years ago. Now we've got Michelle Bachmann. You always should have one Looney Tune running for president. It just makes it interesting. So I'm glad to hear it, if only as a pundit, something to talk about. Justin Duckman, thank you very much for sharing those two interesting bits of news with us. And coming back, we're going to answer the all-important philosophical question that has caused philosophers to wonder throughout the centuries, when is war just? And welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine, proudly filling in for Leslie Marshall. I host my own show in Washington, D.C. called The Inside Scoop, and I host the Raucous Caucus. And you can find out everything you want to find out about me. Just go to marklevine.tv, MarkLevine.tv, because I don't just do radio. I also do TV. And I'm answering the age-old question, when is war just? Now, we dealt in the last hour with when is war legal. And I want to deal with when is war just. And I want to hear from you. You don't have to agree with me. Let me know what you think. 888-653-7543. I think war is just in self-defense. And I think war is just to prevent mass murder. And therefore, I supported Action Rwanda. I supported Action Darfur. I was very, very proud of what we did in Bosnia. I supported the war in Afghanistan because I thought that was self-defense. I did not support the war in Iraq because I don't think that was in self-defense. I don't think it was to prevent mass murder, and oil is not enough for me. Now, does that mean that we fight every war that's in self-defense? Probably, although, you know, you can argue whether we have to go all the way to war to defend ourselves. Should we fight every war to stop mass murder? Well, you know, I mean, not if we're going to get crushed. I mean, fighting China, if they decided to murder all the Tibetans, would be really hard. But generally, if we can, yes, we should. I think there are just wars out there. The other wars? Less sympathetic. Less sympathetic. What do you think? When is war just? And then coming up later in this hour, the really all-important question raised by a play that I saw last night of where America would be without unions, where the Republicans want to take us. That what would it be like to have an America without worker protections? That's coming up soon, right after we resolve the all-important question of when is war just. Daily Dave, Welcome to the show, and tell me when you believe, if any, at any time, when is war just?
That's a much more difficult question.
Of course it is. That's why I asked you.
There's two kinds of war. I mean, there's several justifications for war, like manifold. But there's two reasons for war, and one is a war of acquisition and a war of defense. So if we look back, I mean, you're a student of history, and when you opened the show, you know, you gave several examples of, you know, our invasions and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But a good example of a war of acquisition would be the American Revolution.
Really? That's a war? See, I was thinking you were going to say the U.S.-Mexican War. To me, that's the ultimate, or the Spanish-American War. There we went out and invaded territory that we didn't own.
I'm just going back a little bit further.
But the American Revolution, that was a war of acquisition? That's a new one to me. Explain why.
I will try.
Okay.
The Britannia,
yes,
was the ruling party, or the ruling class, over the American colonies.
Right.
And so the landed individuals, gentry
mm-hmm.
of America decided, why are we shipping off these materials and these potential, you know, these potential products? Because it's always, you know, what potential the land has.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the land offers us cotton or wheat or timber mm-hmm. or gold, or the land offers us, you know, labor. You know,
uh-huh.
the people that live there are a labor force. And,
right.
And if you mix the materials with labor, then that creates wealth.
Okay, so your argument is that the American Revolution was fought because the rich Americans, the landed gentry, the plantation class decided what?
That they wanted to acquire the property, the bounty and the labor that existed in the colony.
But Daily Dave, they already owned the bounty. They owned slaves. They owned cotton. They traded it to Great
Britain. But they were sending too much of it to Britain. Britain.
You mean because of the taxes?
I mean, because it's such a small landmass, they, for many centuries, I mean, I'm Welsh, so you need to understand that Wales was the very first country that Britain ever invaded. And so Libya has oil, and Bahrain, for example, which is and Yemen, which are going through their own, you know, their own civil uprisings and so forth. We want to maintain. I mean, we want Libyan oil as, you know, in part in our mercantile class. And so that's why this would be a war of acquisition. Does that make any sense?
Well, I tell you, I'm not entirely convinced of your argument, Dave, because, you know, it seems to me that it wasn't taxation during the American Revolution. It was taxation without representation.
That's a fantasy, Mark.
Well, you know, we can disagree on history, but I mean, you know, I've certainly read what the founders wrote and what Thomas Jefferson wrote, and I've read the Declaration of Independence, and that may, I mean, I don't think it was all just a patina. I mean, I think that if Britain had given America representation in Parliament, there probably wouldn't have been an American Revolution. Now, you and I can disagree on that. Maybe it would have come up later. But there were certainly lots of people in America that fought that were not landed gentry, right? That, you know, ordinary yeoman farmers that fought. So I guess,
but
I mean, I respect
fight,
you, Dave. I understand what
I mean,
you're saying.
Why war is waged and why we fight are two different questions. Like 9/11, you know, the war in Afghanistan would be a war of retribution.
Right. Revenge, self-defense, sure.
Right. Well, no, not self-defense.
Okay, revenge.
Afghanistan did not represent a real threat to America.
That was the justification
for war, which taxation was the justification for the American Revolution.
Let me say this, and I, you know, I wanted to give you a long time to expound.
And you did. I appreciate that.
I think that Was Afghanistan a threat in the sense of an invasion or they're going to conquer America? No, of course not. But clearly, Al-Qaeda was determined to kill large numbers of Americans. They still are. And to me, that made it legal. That made it self-defense. That made it
I don't mean to be crass or anything like that, but the Nazis in Eastern Europe,
yeah,
knowing what we think we knew then, we had every reason, like as we, you know, the no-fly zone in Bosnia.
Right.
We had every reason to intervene in the Nazi expansionism.
Yes, we did.
Into Poland because we knew what were doing to the minority class.
And I wish we'd gotten involved in World War II earlier before Pearl Harbor. I think we could have saved more lives.
Exactly. But that suddenly becomes a gray area. And until our mercantile interests are threatened, it's only then that we get involved.
I don't think that's always true. In fact, I think the Kosovo War is a clear example, maybe the best example, of a war that was entirely fought for humanitarian reasons, and it's a war that I strongly supported.
I don't think anyone can argue
that our intervention in Kosovo was for some commercial military or acquisition purpose.
Right, but it was minimal. It wasn't minimal.
We stopped a genocide. It took about 90 days. Three Americans died. We basically bombarded Belgrade pretty hard. It wasn't as big as some other wars, but it was bigger than Grenada, the Barbary Pirates. It was a significant war.
Right.
If we could do the same thing
in Libya and have Europe step in. I mean,
but that's exactly what the president is trying to do, Dave.
Right. The president is acting on the treaty, on the NATO and European treaties that are in place.
That's exactly right. So he's justified that way. He is trying the minimal war. This is not in Afghanistan or Iraq. This is not an all-out war. This is not ground troops. You just heard the announcement. He's putting NATO in charge. It's no-fly zone. This, to me, is a lot more like Kosovo than it is like Iraq. And that's one reason why I support
this
action.
That's what I hope for as well.
Thank you for your call, Dave.
Thank you, sir.
When we come back, I want to address my next topic, a very important one. The question of what would America be like without unions? We got a glimpse of it when we look at what's happening in China today. 888-653-7543. Right back after this. Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine, proudly filling in for Leslie Marshall. We talked about when war is legal, when war is just. If you still want to talk about that, you can feel free to call in at 888-653-7543. But I want to move on this hour, and I only got the remainder of the hour. Leslie is coming back for the third hour. You will hear her at 9:06 sharp. But I want to talk about a play I saw last night. Now, I don't usually do theater reviews. That's not my thing, though I do like the theater. And I saw an amazing performance last night, and no, I'm not being paid to say this. The artist does not even know I'm saying this. This is real. The artist's name is Mike Daisy, spelled like the flower. And before I get to the topic, which had to do with, technology and Apple and, frankly, the fact that people are working in appalling working conditions in China to make our technology in America. Before I get to the actual topic, I want to talk a little about the performance. Because if you look at this guy and you look at if you know in advance what he's about to do, you'd be singularly unimpressed. I think people would probably get up and leave the theater. This is, what was the theater production? For 2 hours, a little more than 2 hours, this guy talked to us. And if you ever sat in church or synagogue or in a mosque and heard a bad sermon, you know how interminable 10, 15, 20 minutes can be. And yet this guy talked for 2 hours, just sat at a table and talked to us. The set is a table and a chair. And I and the entire audience was mesmerized. He is that good. He ain't much to look at. I got to tell you, this isn't like, something to look at. I mean, let's be honest here. I don't think Mike Daisy would mind me saying he's overweight. He sweats a lot. He's not the best looking guy in the world. In fact, he's doesn't look that good at all. It doesn't matter. The point is, he was so exceptional in what he did last night at the Woolly Mammoth Theater in Washington, D.C., and I encourage everyone to go see it. He moved me tremendously. He taught me things that, frankly, I'm embarrassed I didn't know already, but that I want to share with you. What he talked about in a wonderful style that was both funny and meaningful and talking all about technology, what he talked about is the working conditions in the third largest city in China, a city called Shenzhen. And if you've never heard of it, don't worry. I'm embarrassed to admit I hadn't heard of it either. It used to be a fishing village a few decades ago. And it is now a city of 14 million people where people beg, plead, do whatever they want, bribe to get in. And people work 75-hour weeks, 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds. You work until the plant cut your hand off. Then, of course, you lose your job under appalling working conditions to create the products that you and I like so much, the technology. And it's not just Apple. He was picking on Apple because Apple's an industry leader. It's Nokia, it's Motorola, it's IBM, it's everybody. When it says made in China, it's made in Shenzhen. In fact, he said, and I have no reason to doubt him because he's pretty knowledgeable on this, that 52% of all the technological products we have in America are made not in China, but made specifically in Shenzhen, in this appalling place of awful working conditions that reminds me of where America was 110, 120 years ago and where we will go back, mark my words, if the Republicans have their way. And I'm going to tell you more about that on the other side of the break. If you want to dial in, it's 888-653-7543. This is Mark Levine. Back in a bit. Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine, proudly filling in for Leslie Marshall. I am a Washington, D.C. based talk radio host, and I don't often do theater reviews. In fact, I think in the, 8 years I've been on radio, I don't think I've ever done one. But hey, there's a first time for everything. And if you live within 100 miles of Washington, D.C., you've got to go to the Woolly Mammoth Theater on D Street. They did not pay me to say this. This is not a paid commercial. They don't even know I'm doing this. You got to watch Mike Daisy's one-man show, which I've really made sound unexciting because I told you he's not good-looking and all he does is sit at a table and talk to you. But I guarantee you will be mesmerized. First of all, he's funny. He's really, really funny. And I'm not doing him justice because I'm not, you know, really conveying how good he... I mean, it's hard to do it without doing... I guess part of it, before I get to the actual topic, which I'm getting there, but part of it, I got to say, I'm a radio host. So I'm a storyteller. You got to be. If you do talk radio, you got to tell stories. And so I'm in awe of Mike Daisy because he's so damn good at it. I am, as someone who practices the craft, I have to bow before the superior storyteller. And he is amazing. And he tells the story of his adventures in Shenzhen, China, and how he pretended to be an American businessman who came there, because lots of American businessmen do go to Shenzhen, and they, that's spelled S-Z-E-N-C-H-E-N, if you want to look it up. And they go because they want cheap labor. They want to exploit cheap labor. And if you think that ever since the Civil War, American businessmen haven't had slaves, you haven't been keeping up. We did pass the 13th Amendment. Slavery is illegal in the United States. But American businessmen make oodles of money hand over fist using Chinese slaves. Oh, I know. They're not slaves. They're paid 10 cents a day or whatever they're paid. But when a 13-year-old has to work 75 hours to make your iPod or your iPhone... And I happen to like Apple products. It's certainly not just Apple. To make your PC, to make your BlackBerry, to make anything. Do you ever wonder why it is that from the beginning of time until 2000, American workers in every single decade did better than the decade before? Every decade. They did better in 1890, then in 1880, in 1930, then 1920, 1940. They did better in 2000, 1990, until this last decade. For the first time in American history, American workers went backward. It just happened to be under 8 years of George W. Bush. The median wage the average wage, the wage in America, of which half make more and half make less, dropped by $2,000, real dollars. Not after inflation. No, it actually just dropped. Why? Because American workers cannot compete with slaves. They can't compete with a 13-year-old working day in and day night until their fingers are numb and sometimes their hands get crushed in machines, making the wonderful technology that we all love so much. And Mike Daisy did a better job because I'm just giving you the harshness, and he told some really funny stories about, listen, we all love technology. I love technology. I love my iPhone. I got one. I love my PC. I love my computer. I love my Apple Macintosh. But Apple uses slave labor in China. They all do. And for me, now Mike Daisy's point was to call Apple, tell them you know what they're doing, get them to stop because Apple's an industry leader, and if they stop, everyone else would. That's Mike Daisy's point. It's a good one, and I fully support it. But it isn't what I thought about as I was transfixed by his story. What made me so interested in his story was I thought about right here at home. I thought about effects on America. I thought of three things. One, I thought of how America was 100, 110, 120 years ago. Number two, I thought about America today and how hard it is to compete with slave labor. And number three, I thought about Wisconsin and where the Republicans want to take us. So let's go through it. First of all, America 100 years ago, 110, 120 years ago. If you haven't read Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, you owe it to your country to pick up that book, written at the turn of the century, a book that I read in high school. But, you know, there's certain books that just change your whole worldview. For conservatives, I guess it's Ayn Rand, The Bible of Selfishness, right? Atlas Shrugged, The Fountainhead. For me, it was Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. Now, he was preaching socialism, but it's not the result he preached. It's the real conditions in America that he talked about, where people would work day in, day out, 6 days a week, thank God for the Sabbath day. But they would work 12, 13, 14 hours in those 6 days. They'd sleep all day Sunday under appalling conditions, under no worker safety. And if their hands got chopped off, you better not get blood on the products or in the meat. It probably would go in the meat. In fact, Theodore Roosevelt read the book and began the Food and Drug Administration because he didn't like the fact that chopped American human body parts were finding their ways in our meat factories. But if you got your hand cut off, not only was there no worker safety, no workers' comp, you lost your job. Probably lost your life. In New York at the turn of the century, garment workers would work in factories. Listen, my grandmother, my great-grandmother. Maybe my grandmother. No, I think it was my great-grandmother. Worked in one of those factories, you know, where you're sewing all day long. Anyway, in New York, prior to unions, there was a fire in a garment factory. And the people ran down the stairs to get out, but they had locked the door from the outside, because they didn't want garment workers to steal little bits of cloth they might take home. They went up to the roof and went down the fire escape, but the fire escape couldn't handle more than five or six people, and it crashed to the ground. The main stairway was on fire. So many jumped to their deaths from the roof. 164 people died. They didn't have sprinklers. They didn't have fire extinguishers. As I said, the fire escape didn't work. The door was padlocked from the outside. 164 Americans, mostly new immigrants, murdered by their employer. That's what changed. That's why we have unions. That's why Americans marched. That's why they fought, and boy, did they fight. They fought the police. They fought the government. Do you know about the Pullman strike? Do you know about the battles that would go on. These were hard-fought benefits. In fact, all you have to do is read about the so-called progressive era. Where do you think we get these words? 1890, 1900, 1910. It was a battle between workers and employers. A physical battle, and many people died. And I'm sorry to say that there's virtually no one alive today that remembers it, because it happened 100 years ago. And too few Americans know their own history. But if you read the history of America from 1890 till, well, the Great Depression, that's what it was about. It was about workers fighting for basic human rights. Worker safety laws. Fire code. Food and Drug Administration. And later on, yes, overtime. You like overtime? You like getting time and a half when you work more than 40 hours a week? Do you know people fought and died for that? And they did it through unions. And I know what you're saying. I don't belong to a union. Those union workers, they get all these benefits that I don't get. Let me tell you something. The only reason you get any benefits at all is because of unions. I know unions are weak in this country. I know that unions are at their lowest level since the Great Depression. I know that only 7% or so of Americans in private industry work in unions and 30% in the government. And I know that Scott Walker and the Republicans are trying to stop it. I know unions are weak. I get it. But unions led the way to our success. The strength of unions led the way to the strong American middle class of the 50s. The 60s, all the way through the Clinton era, and I got to tell you, the decline in unions is leading to the decline in the middle class. The greatest American inequality since, yes, the 1920s, because it's the greatest fall in unions since the 1920s. When the Republicans are trying to destroy public sector unions, don't believe they're going to stop there. When you attack unions, you attack working people. And I know you're saying, but there are some unions that are corrupt. Yeah, there are. There are some unions that are corrupt. In every industry, there are some people who are corrupt. I'm all for fighting corruption. We can agree on that. But the basic principle of collective bargaining, the basic principle of unions, without unions, we are China. Without unions, we are 12-year-olds fighting for our lives in factories. And they're the ones making our products today. And if you've ever had not had a problem with globalization, you should. And you know what? I'm willing to pay a little more for my electronics. And you should be too. If we're going to fight a war to prevent the massacre of people in Libya, and I think we should also be concerned about the human rights of the people that make the things we play with. Mike Daisy, you have inspired me. And I hope that to use your play to inspire others. If you live in the Washington, D.C. area, please go see the agony and ecstasy of Steve Jobs at the Woolly Mammoth Theater. I am not paid for this, I assure you. They don't even know I'm doing it. If not, you can read about it. You can Google it. Find out how common child labor and terrible working conditions are, because if we have to compete with that, we can't compete. We shouldn't compete. There should not be a race to the bottom. I am more than willing to pass legislation to prohibit any imports created by workers who live in unsanitary, unhealthy, terrible working conditions. You know what? It would raise prices, and those are prices I'm willing to pay. 888-653-7543. What do you think? This is Mark Levine. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine filling in for Leslie Marshall. I have enjoyed my 2 hours. You can hear from Leslie at the top of the hour. If you want to contact me, go to my website, marklevine.tv, marklevine.tv. You may have heard of other websites for me, marklevineradio.com. They all get to me. And you can comment on my Facebook page, the Mark Levine fan page. Let me know what you think about today's show. Let me know what you think we should do about the fact that most of our electronics are made by close to slave labor, and what you think the Republicans want for America. Do they want us to be like Shenzhen, China? I submit to you that they do, even when they don't know what they're doing. Dick in Rochester, welcome to the Leslie Marshall Show.
Yes. Hi, Mark. How are you?
Hello. Welcome.
I have to admit, I like your point of view. I like the way you tackle these issues head on. You say what needs to be said, and it's very your approach is very clear.
Thank you. I
very
appreciate
easy
that.
To get engaged in. So I was trying to think of write down a number of things that the unions got the American worker.
Oh, yeah.
Some of them have been disappearing, and there's no coincidence that that's happening because a lot of unions have been disappearing also.
Sure. Overtime, pensions, work safety code, you probably have a long list yourself.
The 40-hour work week.
Right.
A lot of people have to work mandatory overtime now because companies figure it's cheaper to have to pay overtime to the same number of people than to hire new people.
Right. But before unions, you weren't paid time and a half. Before unions, you just worked.
Right. So, and a lot of people really don't want the overtime, but they don't have a choice. Health care benefits, workers are having to pay more and more of this. Some workers, aren't given any health care benefits at all at their job.
Mm-hmm.
And how about the big one, pensions?
Yeah, very.
A lot of places don't offer pensions anymore. My gosh, that was a great thing where you didn't have to rely on Social Security for your only income after you worked. Pension was your main source. Child labor laws, we have those, but I understand. I think I heard Alan Combs say that there's somebody in Congress who wants to chop into that a little bit and be able to hire people below the age of 16 or something. I don't remember the specifics.
Well, one of the things I remember is that when this crazy judge in Virginia said that the Affordable Health Care Act was unconstitutional, his argument was that it was unconstitutional just like child labor laws are unconstitutional. So it's clear that in judiciary, where the right-wing judges would take us,
mm-hmm.
And that is in the heart of where they want to go. I'm promoting stuff tonight, right? I talked about a good play. Have you ever read Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, Dick?
I did in school, yes.
So you read it too. A lot of people have. I'm always surprised by how many people have read it. To me, that's a searing memory. The Lithuanian immigrants and Jurgis and the wedding and the one good day they have. I read that in high school. And I've never forgotten it. And I just, one more thing, it's a book, you can buy it, I'm sure it's in paperback, I'm sure it's not expensive. You need to know where our country was 100 years ago if you don't want to be there 20 years from now. You know, those who don't remember history are condemned to repeat it. And that is the direction we are heading. That's why Wisconsin made me so upset.
Yes, I agree. I think your memory might be better of it than mine was. To me, it was almost so extreme. There was almost a sense that is this partly fiction? But it wasn't.
It wasn't fiction. I mean, it was a fictionalized account of reality in America. And in fact, the truth is even worse in some cases, like the garment workers fire that I told you about, which led to the creation of the Garment Workers Union that still exists today.
That was just about 100 years ago, I think.
That's right.
That last week or last month, something
That's right.
like that.
That fire was 100 years ago. Dick, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. Stick around. Become my friend on Facebook, and let's stay in touch, all right?
All right, Mark. Thanks.
All right. Thanks so much. Let's go to Dave in Bayside, California. Dave is a longtime listener. He's been listening to my show, I think, close to 7-8 years now. Hey, Dave, how are you?
Yes, and as is most often the case, I find myself once again in agreement with you, Mark. I definitely feel that the unions have been the big hope for the working people of this country, and if it hadn't been for them, I think we'd be still all on the Walmart type of a wage. One of the thoughts I was having, though, when you try to compute the mean or median income of this country, when you weigh in the fact that the millionaires and billionaires are doing so well, that the person who's struggling at the minimum wage level, I wonder how it all does balance out.
Well, that's actually why I said median and not mean, for those who remember their math. The mean is the average. So basically, if Bill Gates walks into this room and there's 100 of us, suddenly all our average wages go up, millions of dollars. That's why I don't use the mean or the average. I think that's a misleading wage because we don't all get richer when a few of us get richer. The median is the better measurement. It's the middle person. It's 50% are richer, 50% are poor, and that is what declined in the last 10 years for the first time in American history. every other decade, even, you know, from the Great Depression, right, 1920, 1930, 1930, 1940, every single decade, the average, when I say average, the median worker, the guy in the middle, the 50% wage earner, has done better until George W. Bush. And I'm not saying it was entirely George W. Bush at all. What I'm saying is that we are coming to a time of globalization, a time of outsourcing. Slavery was prohibited in this country ever since 1868, 1865. And now they found they can get that slavery just by going abroad. And if we don't talk about it, we've got to understand not just how much suffering the people are undergoing in China, but how American workers are suffering because we can't compete and we shouldn't have to compete with children who are in slave-like conditions.
Do keep up your good efforts, Mark, and it's good to be hearing you again.
It's always good to hear from you, Dave. I'm sorry to hear about Alice, but I know that you're still listening, and I'm very glad you are.
He always listened to you to the end.
I remember. Alice was great. Alice was Dave's mother, and she would call, I think, into her 90s and talk about she remembered when Social Security first started. I didn't have many callers like that. I very much appreciate it. Thank you again, Dave, for your call, and thank you, everyone in Leslie's audience. Leslie will be back at the top of the next hour, so you're going to hear from her very soon. I don't know what her topic is. You'll hear from her. Again, if you want to find out anything from me, my website is marklevine.tv, marklevine.tv. You can watch me argue with Bill O'Reilly or the other people at Fox or on CNN Headline News or CNBC. You can listen to my radio shows when I'm on the Leslie Marshall Show. You can listen to clips of me. If you've missed part of tonight's show, that will be up there as well. Facebook me. You can also follow me on Twitter at MarkLevineTV. Stay in touch because I love Leslie's fans, and I know many of you like me too. Thank you again for listening in. Back at the top of the hour is Leslie Marshall.